My name is John Sweetman, and this is Lines of Inquiry, Case Notes. This is a little different to our usual episodes. Case Notes is a new strand of Lines of Inquiry, where we step away from telling one specific case in detail and instead take time to reflect, revisit past investigations, and respond directly to you, the listener. These episodes are conversation-based. Sometimes that will mean returning to old cases with guest contributors. Other times, like today, it means opening the inbox and engaging with the questions, observations, and information people have shared with us. You can get in touch with us at linesofinquiry@goloudnow.com. We have received a huge amount of emails and feedback since Lines of Inquiry began, and for this first episode of Case Notes, we want to take the time to go through some of that correspondence, respond to it properly, and reflect on what listeners have brought to the series. This episode also brings Season 1 of Lines of Inquiry to a close. Your support allows us to tell these stories. I have been overwhelmed by the level of backing to date. It means you will not have to wait long for new cases. Season 2 begins on January 6th, 2026. For this very first episode of Case Notes, I am joined in the studio by the creator of Lines of Inquiry and head of digital audio at Barrow Media, Darren Cleary. Darren, you're very welcome.
John, thank you very much for having me. Your first season has come to a close. How have you found it all?
Well, I still find it quite surreal. I think it was late October, first episode came out early November, and the weeks have just flown by. And I can't believe that we've already got, you know, 8 episodes, or I suppose technically 9 in the bag, because we had a two-parter. But I find it brilliant. Great.
What year did you retire?
I retired towards the end of 2023. So I'm gone nearly exactly 2 years when this popped up.
How has it felt reopening the old case files? Because there's a mix, obviously. You're looking at some of the cases that would have helped define Ireland over the last 50 years. But you're also looking at cases that you yourself personally worked on.
It came back quite easy. Like, you know, I started to recall things that, you know, I put to bed maybe a couple of decades ago. But even without going into the cases that I was involved in, I found it fascinating getting involved in the other stories as well. And you never kind of lose that perspective that you're looking at things with a Garda point of view. But I found it different now because there's no pressure on me for preparing stuff for court and stuff like that. So I'm able to get more invested into it.
And when you pick up a story, one maybe that you haven't worked on, do you find yourself reverting to the Garda detective mode and thinking about what did the scene look like? What did they do first? Who was on site?
Yeah, like, I mean, certainly for the ones I wasn't involved in, I've been going down the rabbit hole and, you know, I'm on Google Maps and seeing if I can get street views of these places to get a kind of a feel for it. And I do have it in the back of my head all the time about what probably was going on from an investigative type point of view during these investigations. I just find it fascinating finding out about things that I wasn't even aware of, you know.
The cases you've covered so far in season one, I'm sure every one of them stays with you in a different way. But I suppose the way you described it is, it's followed me around my whole career. The Midlands Letter,
yeah,
The Beast.
Yeah.
That's one that probably is the standout one. It's the one that's most talked about, even internally, because it was such an unknown case. It's probably amplified now, that sense that it follows you around after shining the spotlight on it here.
For me, it's a little bit different from the inside looking out. At the time, it was just another case, but it happened to be one that grew legs and it went on for a longer period of time than most similar cases like that, you know, with question handwriting. And because of the serious nature of it and the content that were in all these letters, I did realise at the time that this one would be one that I'd remember. But I never dreamt that I'd be still talking about it, like, almost on a daily basis. Like, any time I meet somebody, they say to me about the Midlands Letters one, you know. But yeah, that one's going to follow me around for a while, I think. And I believe the individual involved in that is due for release possibly next year. And I think on the strength of the podcast, on the episode that we did on the Midlands Letters, it's come into, you know, a little bit more into the public domain. So I'm fully expecting it to be still nipping at my heels for a while yet.
Yeah, there'll still be a lot of conversation when Liam Finlay does end up as someone who might be about to be released. We won't give too much away of how the process works. I'm not sure if people would be too interested in the mechanics of how you write a script, how you edit a script, how you go through it. But one thing I probably struck the wider team is, you know, the openness of guards to have a chat with you and talk about how they've managed very tough investigations. Yeah. Is that something you found really helpful, being able to pick up the phone and talk to people?
Yeah.
You know, like Alan Bailey on Nora Sheehan, for example.
Certainly any retired members that either myself or other people involved in the script writing have contacted. You said Alan Bailey there, who was one of the founding members of the Serious Crime Review Team, or the Cold Case Unit. And he was very helpful, as you say, with the Nora Sheehan episode. Likewise, retired guard, I think he was a super when he retired, Frank Keenahan, who was the senior investigating officer with the Justine Valdez case, which we are bringing to, I think, season two. Again, very, very helpful. Obviously, you know, when you're dealing with serving members, you have to be a bit more careful. Some of the cases that I was involved in, they're okay to talk to me about it because I was involved in it. But in general, like, I mean, I could pick up the phone and I was maybe trying to follow up on something with a particular guard station. And while I mightn't get anywhere with that, maybe the guard on the end of the phone starts telling me about some other case. And I'm making notes like, this could make a brilliant episode. Like, you know, and again, cases that I wasn't aware of and maybe the public weren't aware of.
Does it feel in some ways being a guard again? You're investigating things, picking up the phone?
No, it doesn't, because I'm not constrained by anything really. Like, you know, I can sit down and spend as much time as I want trying to find out about something, research something. Maybe if I'm doing some script writing, I just, you know, start firing words at the page. I know that other members on the team are going to have a look at that and polish it or change it or make suggestions. So, like, it's much more freer when you're still a guard. You have to do things a certain way, you know, within certain parameters, and you're bound by different legal aspects. Whereas this is very free, like, and the only danger is that you start looking into something and then you're off down some other path and you have to try to find your way back to what you're meant to be writing about. But no, it doesn't feel like I'm back being a guard doing guard work. It feels fresher and newer, like.
In the best way possible.
Absolutely, yeah.
We've had some listener questions. We talk about the interaction. We have an email address now, linesofinquiry@goaloudnow.com. John and the team have been reading those emails and replying where possible. Some we've saved for this episode. We knew was on the horizon, this new strand of case notes, which will be done not instead of the normal episodes, the normal case-focused episodes, but in addition to them. And some of the questions we'll go through first. Marcella writes, good podcast, really well done and presented. Over your experience, how often does a case hinge on a single very small piece of evidence?
In my experience, very rarely. There's so many facets involved, and I was part of one section, be it the Technical Bureau, which again is only a small part of a criminal investigation, but can be very, very important. Like, I was very lucky in that my first time out on a murder scene, and we covered it in season one, the Marie Dillon case, you know, that was a whodunit, and it was pretty much cracked by fingerprint evidence. That was that one small thing. The culprit in that may or may not have been caught otherwise. Like, it was a different time. There was no CCTV much around or anything like that. And was one that I was involved in that hinged on one small piece of forensic evidence. It's rare enough that you get cases like that. It's usually a combination of everything, of good forensic work, of good investigative work. It all comes together.
The next one has asked to remain anonymous. He says he's a beat mule. What's a beat mule?
That's the term that guards refer to each other, and it's not a derogatory term. That's what we would call each other. You know, you'd say, you see a man down there, oh yeah, he's a mule. It's just a nickname that guards give each other. It's not really rank dependent. Like, anybody can be a mule once you're in the job. And again, in the job is in the guards. But he'd be probably a regular guard in uniform and on the beat, probably one of the more, in my opinion, more difficult jobs in the Guards, is the frontline guys and girls out there dealing with the public every day. So that's what he'd be referring to, like, you know.
Well, that's why he's asked to be anonymous. But his question is, what advancements in forensic science do you wish existed earlier in your career?
What did change over the years, and thinking of some older cases that you were on, was that everything is like with your mobile phones, and that everything got so much smaller. Like, we used to have equipment in the lab for examining finger marks and trying to fluoresce them before you'd photograph them. And this thing was the size of a big fridge freezer. And nowadays, like, they're the size of a hand torch. You can bring them with you to the scene. You know, thinking of some scenes that I was on, it would have been great to have the equipment that the likes of the National Scenes of Crime Unit have now. It just makes your job so much easier. And, you know, getting into little nooks and crannies and stuff with small little pieces of equipment instead of going in like a Ghostbuster with some big power pack on you or whatever.
Gillian says, how often, if at all, did you encounter pressure, internal or external, to reach a conclusion in an investigation? And do you find it difficult to discuss cases now in the podcast where the Garda investigations have left a lot to be desired?
I don't have any difficulty speaking about cases if it's an opinion that maybe things weren't done that should have been done. Once it's accurate, it's very easy for me on the outside, if I'm not involved in a particular investigation, to be critical. But I don't know maybe what's going on behind the scene. And like the first part of the question there, sometimes there is pressure applied if it's a high profile case. I haven't really experienced that much myself, because in general, I think the more pressure you apply to people for results, the less likely you're going to get good results. But I have seen it with other colleagues of mine over the years where pressure was put on to get results. And it really only generates, you know, a negative working environment. It doesn't happen that often nowadays. There's just too much accountability. People are, you know, generally left to get on with the job, whatever it be, at a scene, be it a photographer or a ballistics person, fingerprinter, mapper. You know, the senior officers or whatever in charge of an investigation know that these people are experts and they know what they're doing. They know that if they're going to start annoying you, you're not going to go any faster or anything like that, you know.
There's only so fast you can go through it all. A question, it's from Pauline. Hi, John, my brother is a guard and he introduced me to your podcast. Great podcast. It strikes me how little we hear from Garda in Ireland compared to regular news shows you see with police in America and England. What would you like the public to understand about forensic work that is rarely portrayed?
Well, it's not magic. It's not rocket science. Okay, it's not as easy as they portray it in TV shows where you just go in and shine a blue light on the wall and say, that's whatever. Forensic work at a crime scene is a combination of various different disciplines, you know, ballistics, fingerprints, mapping, whatever. So it's very much a collaborative effort. There's no one expert goes into a scene that knows everything. They'll know about their own particular part of it, be it fingerprints, etc. Even members delivering stuff to the lab to get examined, like, they have a part to play. It's everybody. Like, the first ever murder case that I was just barely involved with, I was still a probationer guard, and I was just happened to be the guard that dispatched the patrol car to this call that turned out to be a dead body. I had only a tiny small part to play in that, and more often than not, that kind of thing would be just read into evidence and accepted. But I ended up in the Central Criminal Court getting cross-examined over why there was a two-minute delay in the car being sent out. So everybody has a part to play. Every little part has to fit together. And no one thing is more important than the other, is what I kind of learned over the years. On lines of inquiry, we do tend to focus a lot on the forensic aspect of it because it is a massive part of these investigations, but one part of an investigation. Like, I used to see, I'd be heading down to the court with, I'd have a big thick file, maybe like a phone book with all my marks and lifts and stuff like that. But then you'd see the investigation team coming in with boxes and boxes and boxes of stuff. So we're only a small part of what goes into an investigation like that, you know.
The feedback has been really positive, John, but one thing in some of the comments is about the cases that are solved. People generally, one or two, not a massive amount, rather the cases that end neatly. What do you say to those people?
Well, I'm glad they like the cases that end neatly, because they do make great stories, and that's what we're here for, is to tell stories. But not all crimes are solved. You know, all the missing persons, stuff like that. The Barbara Walsh case being an example. And again, I didn't know anything about Barbara Walsh until the script was being put together. And with those type of cases where you don't have a resolution, and we tell the story on the podcast, maybe something will come from that, that somebody somewhere will hear it and say, I remember that, and I remember something about it, and maybe somebody will come forward. So it's important to tell those stories that haven't been solved or resolved, because it would be just fantastic if, in us putting out episodes with cases like that, that it might jog somebody's memory. So I think it's important to mix those ones with beginnings and ends with the more open-ended ones, because they're equally as fascinating. I find them very interesting to talk about, you know.
Yeah, and I guess from your point of view, you want to have a victim-focused approach. You can see that in all the episodes so far. It's about the person, not the perpetrator. And when you want to shine a light on these stories, someone's still waiting for justice. Yeah. Shouldn't be denied justice just because, or a platform, just because there's no kind
absolutely,
of need to the ball
at the end of it. And, you know, whether a case has gone through the courts or whether it hasn't, or there's been no arrests made or something like that, the victims are still there, and you have the victim's family. Like, they have to live with that. And even if there is a resolution, they still have to live with it. So it's important to always remember that behind all these stories that we're telling, there are real people there. And I think certainly so far the scripts have reflected that.
In terms of your season two plan, you'll obviously have a little Christmas break, but season two is coming very early in 2026. Tell our listeners, if you can, what to expect from that. You don't have to tell all the cases, but what one are you working on this week?
I've been working on getting a script together for the Justine Valdez murder, which happened in 2018. I think most people would probably remember it because it was just such an unheard of thing here in Ireland, where, you know, a young woman can get abducted in broad daylight and then a huge search operation kicks into gear. I was involved just in the periphery of that case. I found it absolutely fascinating, but very sad case. And that's just one script that I'm working on. There'll be other, you know, ones coming along. But again, hopefully a mix of maybe recent enough cases people might be familiar with, and then also cases that people won't be familiar with and won't have resolutions.
Also in this case note series you're going to do, in addition to the main ep, you're going to have guests on. You're going to revisit some of the cases. Is that something you're looking forward to do, a more informal chat with people about going back to some of the cases, I guess?
It will be very interesting to have people on that were involved, maybe ex-Garda members in cases, or people that were directly involved in certain incidents, and to have a chat with them about it. It'll just add to it, I think.
When you finish up this season, no more than when you retired from the Guards, do the cases stay with you? Is it one where, you know, you finish an episode, you close it, but in some way do they follow you around
a
bit?
They do follow me a bit around, certainly more now than when I was still in the job, because there was always another case, another file to open, and it was work. It was just something that I did. I got paid for doing it. With this, it's different. And even with the ones, that the stories we've covered that I wasn't involved with as a serving member, they do kind of get under my skin a little bit more. And I found certainly there last week when I turned in a draft for the Justine Valdez case, that was in my head it's still in my head, like, which is a good thing, because you want to be able to tell the story in that kind of headspace where you're very much mindful of, again, the victim's family and the work that went into the investigation. But yeah, they're kind of sticking with me now. Like, I spent 30 years in the job and carried very little baggage with me through all the years that I saw different bits and pieces. But that was different. They were in a different mindset. Whereas this, I find you get more involved with it. But I like it. Well, that brings season one of Lines of Inquiry to a close. From my point of view, this series has been about taking time to look carefully at cases that deserve it, and about listening, not just to the evidence, but to the people who have lived with these stories for years, sometimes decades. One of the most striking things over the course of the season has been the volume of contact we've received from listeners. Comments on Spotify, reviews on Apple, emails to the inbox. People who worked on cases, people who were affected by them, and people who still have questions. That engagement has shaped this series more than anything else, and it is something we take very seriously. I want to thank everyone who has taken time to get in touch. If you have information, questions or reflections you want to share, you can contact us at linesofinquiry@goloudnow.com. As I mentioned earlier, this is the end of Season 1, but it is not the end of Lines of Inquiry. Season 2 begins on January 6th, with new cases already in production, and we will continue to approach them in the same way, carefully, respectfully, and guided by the evidence. Lines of Inquiry is presented by me, John Sweetman. The podcast is created by Darren Cleary. Our executive producer is Owen Brennan. Siobhan Walsh and Siobhan Maguire are our producers. Have a happy Christmas and a safe new year. And remember, in the end, everything done in the dark comes to light.